You're listening to the podcast of the musictherapyresearchblog.com. On this podcast, I'm pleased to speak with Dr. Debbie Carroll, music therapy professor at the University of Quebec at Montreal, where she has been educating and supervising students since 1985. She received her postgraduate diploma in music therapy from the London Guildhall School of Music and Drama and worked as a music therapist in Germany and Canada. An accomplished pianist and clinician with extensive experience in special education and child adolescent psychiatry, Debbie's research interests include children's intuitive musical understandings and the role of an adaptation of melodic intonation therapy in developing the expressive language of children with Down syndrome. She has also developed a guide for teaching clinical improvisation techniques. Debbie presents her work nationally and internationally, and recently she was awarded a lifetime membership from the Canadian Association for Music Therapy in recognition for her outstanding commitment to the organization and to the field of music therapy. That text that I mentioned is called Clinical Improvisation Techniques in Music Therapy, A Guide for Students, Clinicians, and Educators by Debbie Carroll and Claire Lefebvre, her co-author on that particular textbook, which she talks a little bit about at the beginning of this interview. I'm really appreciative of her time. I really appreciated also being able to attend one of her presentations at the Canadian Association of Music Therapy Conference here in 2015, and I hope you enjoy a little bit more about her insights as to her understandings and uses for improvisation in her clinical work as a music therapist. So thank you very much for joining me today, Dr. Carroll. I'd like to first talk to you a little bit about your book, Clinical Improvisation Techniques in Music Therapy, A Guide for Students, Clinicians, and Educators. And I'd like to hear a little bit about your impetus for writing the book. What were you thinking would be a good purpose for this particular textbook to serve?
Well, actually, the book grew out of my experiences, many years experiences of teaching clinical improvisation techniques with music therapy undergraduate students. And what I was noticing that they really needed a clear, systematic way of using the improv techniques. And this led me to think of different ways on how I could best fulfill that need. We had been looking at the 1987 book by Ken Brusha, The Improvisation Models of Music Therapy, and the taxonomy of clinical improv techniques. I felt that perhaps a regrouping of those techniques within a therapy oriented or process oriented way of looking at it would be more helpful. And this is what I did. I collaborate with a colleague who was teaching the first year students. I was usually teaching the final year students in clinical improvisation. So really, it grew out of that expressed need for that was expressed by the students, and my realization that they needed something that was a little clearer. And of course, Ken Brusha's taxonomy provided the inspiration for regrouping the techniques and for regrouping them in a more logical way, in a way that would serve the students perhaps a little better.
Mm-hmm. So my second question is a little bit about the students that I'm currently working with. I like to ask them about their undergraduate experiences, but what were your experiences in terms of improvisation and composition during your education and practica? Can you tell me a little bit about, was improvisation always a really big part of how you looked at your clinical practice?
Mm-hmm. Actually, improvisation played a big part in my education
the practicum with Mary Priestley. So with Juliet Alvin, she really focused a lot on improvisation and stressed continually the need to become aware of the musical elements, the elements of music, and the ability to manipulate them in certain ways to achieve therapeutic results. So that was something that was always impressed upon me. And in fact, maybe I'll just go a little bit earlier in time. And my interview to when I was being interviewed to when I was applying for the program, I was asked, among other things, of course, to play a piece on the piano, to accompany myself on guitar, but also I was also faced, and I was not aware of this, but at the piano, they presented me with a black and white impressionistic painting of a moonlight and asked me to improvise it. And I was really kind of floored because I just didn't know, but I did it. I had not really had much experience in improvisation, as many of my students that I found out many, many years later, most of them were classically trained. Mm-hmm. In fact, now a lot of students are also coming in with popular music and are much more eclectic. But in those days, back in the day, really a lot of classically trained. So that was my first experience. So during my training, there was a lot of improvisation. In my practicum with Mary Priestley, perhaps I could just give you an example of an experience I had working in an outpatient session with outpatients. It was entitled a psychodynamic music and movement session. Usually the patients came in from their home. They were the outpatients, and they asked. They talked a little bit about where they were at and how they were feeling, and out of that group conversation emerged usually a theme, and that theme was then improvised. Being a practicum, being a student, I was asked to go to the piano and improvise. The theme at that time, at that particular day, was on waiting. One of the patients was talking about waiting at the bus and was really having a lot of panic attacks because she had agoraphobia. And other people were talking about the whole waiting in their different aspects of their life and how difficult it is. So that was the theme. The theme was waiting. So I was asked by Mary Priestley to go to the piano and improvise on waiting. Well, I was not sure when I was to start. So I was looking at her for a cue. So I was waiting for her to start. Right. And so there were so many different layers of waiting happening because my task was to reflect on the conversation, but I myself was experiencing that. So all this to say is that it was really a very inspired improvisation, and I was really quite proud of myself, and I think that it really struck a chord with others, and that was provided the impetus to explore deeper that theme. So that was one of the things. I don't know. Another example of while I was observing Mary Priestley doing improvisation with this patient, after there was a verbal processing and realized that she was playing much too very loud or very soft. And Mary Priestley just suggested, you know, I was struck by the fact that you were playing either very soft, very loud or very soft. Mm-hmm. And this then inspired or motivated the patient to start talking about her relationship, her life, and she's in an abusive situation, and either she would be in a rage or she would be very complacent. She suggested doing another improvisation. So that is when I also learned that working in improvisation can really explore deeper intra and interpersonal levels, and also as a way of becoming more in tune with oneself and with others. Mm-hmm. So that was those were two experiences from my practicum. I also did continuing education. I did an intensive week-long training in New York City with Clive and Carol Robbins, and that was really quite memorable, and that really helped me to also to use it with more with in more able ways when I was working in my clinical work.
And was that more with children? With the I'm sorry to interrupt. When you were working with Robbins and Robbins, though, was that more children based as well?
More children based. Yeah, it was more children based. Yeah, and in fact, maybe I should add that in my my clinical work, I've worked mostly with children with a range with developmental delays, range of different problems, challenges, and I also worked with in child and adolescent psychiatry. There, I did a lot of improvisation. One improvisation, which there were many that stood out, but perhaps one or two that I could talk about. One was a group improvisation with adolescents, and I must say that was really that the improvisational approach was a preferred method or a preferred way of working with these adolescents, because I really believe that that was a way to really help them to establish authentic relationships, sound relationships with each other. Mm-hmm. So in this one incident, one of the teens, she was always playing offbeat. She was always playing, but you could say syncopated, but it was not exactly syncopated, but it was really offbeat. And she was really kind of trying to, as I interpreted it, trying to destabilize the group. Yeah. We talked about it after, because there was always a verbal processing that usually was started with the clients. I usually let them speak first, especially these teens who were cognitively high functioning but had a lot of behavioral issues, suicidal, a lot of suicidal attempts, drug abuse. She realized that I noted that she seemed to be playing off the beat or in maybe an impulsive way, as opposed to pulsive, compulsive, we're not against the beat. She started talking about her life. And I do know that she was admitted to this was a short-term treatment assessment center where I worked. Actually, I worked in Germany at the time. And she told us, I knew that already, that as 16-year-old, she was 16 years old, she was picked up by the police one evening she was running away, a confused, incoherent state. And that in turn led her to this short-term treatment assessment center. She realized that she was always wanting to, she's always being very oppositional. I invited her and others to do another improvisation where she was going to establish a beat and everybody else was going to join in. So it was, she was doing what she wanted to do, but she was being joined by the others. So again, here too, using improv and also subsequent improvisations and series of improvisations to work on different issues is a really a wonderful way of working therapeutically. Do I have time for another one?
Yes, please.
So Rudy entered the large music room, and he didn't seem to mind that the other music therapy group members had not yet arrived. And without saying a word, he took several instruments from the table, and it was a guitar, an auto harp, glockenspiel, and bongo drums. He sat down on the floor, he picked up the guitar, and he surrounded himself with all the other instruments, and he began to play a recurring pattern of two alternating minor chords on the guitar. So it kind of sounded, I don't have my guitar, but it goes, bum, 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 bum. And he strummed it moderately loud, and now and then he stopped playing, and he stopped playing the guitar, and he played another one of the instruments that he had set out on the floor around him very loudly. And he did this again. He strummed a bit, he played another instrument, and this highly structured musical play that he structured himself lasted about 7 minutes. Each time he returned to the guitar, the two-chord pattern became louder and more intense, and it sounded to me like a time bomb ticking away. Mm. The chords finally exploded into a very loud dissonant sound and then silence. And it wasn't long before he explained what had just occurred. He told me that he was the guitar, and the other instruments were the outside world, the reality. In other words, there were each instrument represented a specific person or situation. And he said that often he wants to shut out everything, yet he realized that he needed to face the world and deal appropriately with each person and each situation. Well, that provided fodder for, you know, lots of room to explore further. But at that moment, as he was just finishing off telling me what he was, how he was interpreting the improvisation, the other members of the group came, so I wasn't able to explore further. But if I could have, I would have invited him to role play, to play the guitar, and then to do like a duet or role play with each of these instruments over a longer period of time, and really talk about each of the specific person or and situation. But again, here too, improvisation is rife, ripe with, can really elicit lots of material that one can work with.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the interesting things in especially the last two stories that you shared is your clinical decision making too, which is also improvisatory. There's part of you that had to be, well, it's totally fine if he takes the guitar, auto harp, the bongos, and the glockenspiel.
Yes,
to take them and to be able to go to do that in the corner. And the same thing in the previous anecdote as well, to be able to say to yourself, to have the security in your clinical decision making at that point to go, let's see where this goes, and you know, let's not worry about what the end product is, or maybe worry about, well, I've only got 35 minutes or 45 minutes or whatever it is, and I've got my objectives that I need to work on too. Yeah. How do you sometimes respond to or try to teach that or help other clinicians in supervision or in any kind of context? How do you help them understand or feel more secure about how improvisation can lead you to all these possibilities, like you said?
Well, that is a very good question. I think that I learned by myself from doing it myself. These are examples where I was really I was trusting myself, and I was trusting them. I was trusting that whatever they did was okay, and whatever they did they needed to do, as long as they didn't destroy the instruments or destroy other, you know, or being destructive. For myself, I really was open. I learned that through my training, I think, to really trust the moment. And for sure, my improv classes with this particular guy named Alfred Nieman, which was the subject of a whole chapter that Mary Priestley devoted in her book Music Therapy in Action, and she then included it also in her essays in analytic music therapy about her own experiences, because she also attended the Guildhall School of Music and Drama years earlier than I did. But he also made a huge mark on her. But he was always said to us, you you trust the moment. The moment is, he used the metaphor pregnant. It's pregnant with all kinds of possibilities. And so that is what, and perhaps I just wanted to, in the same situation, at one point, because where I was working, there was no music, it was a pilot project. So I actually started the music therapy program in this big psychiatric short-term institute in Germany. And people were interested in coming and observing what I was doing. One of them was a psychiatrist who was doing his residency, and he came, and at one point the adolescents came in to the room, and one of them was playing on a drum really, really loudly, and another one was trying to and took another drum and interrupted the other. But it was done kind of. It started to be very, very serious and confrontative, but then. They were playing the drums, so the whole playing aspect, and then there was laughing. But before that, the laughing came, or maybe it was nervous laughter. The psychiatrist actually took it upon himself to tell one of them to stop playing because he thought that the drum would break, the skin would break.
Yeah.
And he... You know, I should have told him before he came in, just to say, look, this is my group. You're welcome to observe, but that's all you can do. But I was still a neophyte. I didn't really know, you live and learn. Just to get back to your question, what I tell students who are going out to do their practicum, when they feel that they need to stop an improvisation, sometimes just hold off and count to 10 or, you know, and just to see then what happens, because maybe in those last 5-10 seconds, something very significant might happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Another one that's a little bit more I don't even think this is necessarily for students, but because we know so many clinicians that don't feel like they have an improvisational background, but if they were listening to this and they wanted to jump in, maybe you could talk a little bit, again, from how you arrange it in your textbook, but also I was really impressed at your session at the music therapy conference. You had us just start with some toning and just do some really basic vocal stuff, and then there were some other one-to-one or some dyadic material. What are two or three sort of really basic techniques they could start with, whether they're if they can just get a group of people together or a friend or even by themselves, is there anything that comes to mind that you think would be helpful for them to start with on instruments or vocally, body percussion?
My choice was a very conscious choice to have you do this soundscape based on one tone. Well, one tone that could then open up into others. I don't know if I really spoke about the idea of the unison. And, you know, meeting the client in the music, just using one note. Mm-hmm. What I've done with my students in improvisation, what I felt was very useful was, and again, it was also inspired by Nordoff and Robbins, inspired also by Wigram, and in his book where he talks about the 1, 2, 3, or 4 note improvisations. And I started with students, five students, for example, on their principal instruments, because when I'm in the clinical improv courses that I taught, I also encourage students also to use their principal instruments in improvisation. So for example, there were 5 students with 5 different instruments, and they only improvised on one note. Of course, it could be an octave or 2 octaves. Mm-hmm. And then on 2 notes and then on 3 notes. I usually, I would tape the improvisations, we would listen to it back, and it was really always just startling, just remarkable how varied it was. And a one note improvisation, I think that's a very direct way to establish a contact. Of course, it could be limiting, But starting off there, I think that that's a good, and basically using the techniques, the category, the M1 techniques, as I describe in my book, mm-hmm. the different techniques, basically it's to establish a contact. Mm-hmm. So there's the reflecting, the imitating, the synchronizing, the pacing.
Right. The last bit of questions I mentioned, especially to one of my classes, that I would ask them if they had any questions. This is one that actually just came off of what you were just mentioning, which is your main instrument. So this one says, considering improvisation and composition, what are the benefits of your main instrument of focus in comparison to the other main improvising instruments, both musically and clinically? And do you ever use multiple instruments in one session to achieve different outcomes?
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely, the music therapist and I have, and others use multiple instruments. I think the advantage of using one's principal instrument, firstly, is if it's not piano, voice, or guitar, it really offers another auditory vista for mm-hmm. the clients to explore, to expand their own horizons. And the fact is that usually on the students have already achieved a certain proficiency on their instrument. It's not always so easy then to move from a very, you know, maybe classically or reading the music to kind of letting go on one's instrument. But I definitely think that it is it's a very good idea and very very highly recommended. Mm-hmm. And in my own teaching with the students with their principal instruments, mm-hmm. Often one note improvs, because some of them were really kind of very wary and saying, oh, I can't do this, you know. Right. But just start with one note, mm-hmm. one note. And then as a group, of course, decide on what the note is. And then as a group, and it could be we work in dyads, we work in trios or quartets, you know, bigger, smaller or larger chamber music group, so to speak, and just start with one note, and then two notes. It's a way for them to explore. Not necessarily. Sometimes it's the melodic aspect that really kind of gets them a bit scared, but the rhythmic aspect, the timbre, duration, dynamics, all that can be explored. Using just one or two or three notes to begin with. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, exploring melodic motifs using specific scales. So again, structuring the improv in order to elicit as much freedom of expression. Mm-hmm. There's always a paradox there, but really sometimes the more structure that one provides, depending on what the needs are, the more freedom of expression that structure will elicit and will facilitate.
Yes, thank you very much. My last question is a little bit about research. You've talked, you've given some wonderful anecdotes. We have Bruce's case studies text. There's lots of wonderful stories about improvisation, especially that are done in sort of a case study or single subject design research study. There's even some wonderful RCTs that have been coming out in improvisation that are coming from Europe in particular. I'm wondering if you would direct anybody, if somebody said, I'd really be interested in reading a great research article or a great chapter on improvisation, composition, that sort of thing, where you would direct them? Or on the other side of it, is there a particular way do you think that we should be looking at researching improvisation and composition to better understand its potentials for music therapists?
Well, that's a good question. Requires maybe a little bit of thought. But as far as directing your students to the different writings on or case studies. There's a lot out there. There's also the Cochrane reviews that are that are coming out with children with ASD. I think that there's also in psychiatry too. I'm not sure exactly with that one, but I think that there's so many different ways in which to research. I think that the way to go really is in a fine-grained qualitative study where the multiple voices are heard. In other words, the music that is co-created, the music therapist's understanding of what happened in the music and how and the decisions that music therapist took to facilitate certain responses, and coming from the client too would be really very valuable. I know that Alan Turey did a study, and I remember going to hear him in a conference where he really he took apart an improv that he did with a female client in psychiatry with psychiatric issues, a problem. And it was also, I think it was within the context of a songwriting also, and lyrics too. So there were really multiple layers there. There was the music, there was the words, there was the, you know, how the words were expressed. So there was a lot happening. So I think that, there's lots of room, and I think that more research should be done would be great.
Yeah, I think Alan Turey is a great name to bring up, and I would like to do that more often. And I agree with that. I love hearing his writings. I love hearing him present. And I think he's also a good example, as was your presentation, I think, of helping people, or helping us, the clinicians who are listening to these sorts of presentations, really understand how packed with information improvisations are, that there's so much that can be gleaned from it, and so much to be parsed out, and not to just let it go, well, that was just a moment, we just improvised a little bit, and I'll just document that and move on. That there's really so much richness to those interactions too. So I appreciate you. I appreciate your time and thinking about the questions and everything as well. Thanks so much for joining me today. This has been the Music Therapy Research Podcast, associated with musictherapyresearchblog.com. Your hosts are Dr. Blythe Lagasse and Dr. Andrew Knight, music therapy faculty members at Colorado State University. Follow MTRB on Facebook and your hosts on Twitter to stay up on all the music therapy research we send out into the world. If you enjoyed the podcast, please let us know by heading to iTunes and submitting a review and a rating. It only takes a minute and helps our visibility on the iTunes page tremendously. Thanks in advance. Also, send in a comment about the podcast on the contact page at musictherapyresearchblog.com.